I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. After 2 months in office, President Trump's policies are taking shape and creating some division among his voters, including here in the Midwest. Today, how the president's search for better trade deals is splitting opinions in a Nebraska county that favored Trump heavily in November. Then, folks around here are too familiar with tornadoes and the damage they can do. Taking a cue from construction in hurricane zones, some builders and nonprofits are encouraging building methods that help homes stand up to strong winds. We'll find out how. After that, plan your weekend around the latest weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Up in Dawson County, Nebraska, voters last year sided strongly with Donald Trump. Now the impact of the new president's trade policies is drawing sharply different reactions from residents there. Farmers who back Trump worry about the prospect of a trade war that would undermine their prospects. Other Trump voters, though, think Trump's get-tough policies on trade could protect blue-collar jobs. It's not likely that both sides can come out as winners here. Now a conversation about the impact of America's shifting trade policies on rural America. With us now, Grant Gerlach is with Harvest Public Media, based here at KCUR. He joins us from the studios of NET Nebraska. Grant, nice to have you back.
Good morning. Good to be here.
And speaking of being back, Stephanie Kelton is also back. She's a professor of economics at UMKC. Stephanie, always nice to have you too.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Grant, tell us about 58-year-old Don Batty, if I'm saying his name correctly, who backed Trump and farms 1,500 acres up in Dawson County in Nebraska. What are his concerns about where all this trade policy talk is going?
Well, Don Batty raises corn and soybeans and a little bit of alfalfa up there, a lot of irrigation in that part of the state in the Platte River Valley. And those crops, especially the soybeans, and soybeans in particular, depend on exports. A big chunk, almost half of the soybean supply in the U.S. each year is exported, about $10 billion of it to China. So when they hear talk about trade possibly being disrupted by different policies or, you know, these disputes that could interrupt the exports that they depend on to support the prices that provide their income, that's when they get really nervous. So Don is really nervous about the things he's heard from the Trump administration.
And I should point out that farm country's interest in exports goes well beyond Don's concerns. Lots of agriculture in America relies heavily on exports. Do I have that right, Grant?
Yeah. You know, soybeans, a lot of beef, a fair amount of ethanol now is exported. So when they're looking for growth in prices, I mean, there's a certain amount of demand that there's going to be in the U.S. for their crops. They look for growth in these export markets a lot of times in order to provide the prices that they depend on.
Hmm. Okay, same county, and you visited with a man named Junior Dishman who spent 40 years at the former Tenneco factory up there. It makes shock absorbers. He has a sharply different set of feelings about Trump's policies. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're in a rural area, but this is the kind of factory job that you may think of when you think of the difference in the election in Wisconsin or Pennsylvania. I mean, he's a blue-collar worker. He worked at Tenneco making shock absorbers for 40 years. So did his wife. So really, both of their incomes depended on this factory work. When it shut down several years ago, he basically headed toward retirement. Luckily, you know, he was at the point where he could do that. A lot of families, young families in particular, that lived in Cozad and worked at Tenneco, followed the jobs wherever they went. And that included Arkansas, Georgia, and some of the jobs also were outsourced to plants in Canada and Mexico that were part of the company also.
And unlike Don Batty, then, Junior Dishman likes the idea of putting tariffs on imports. Why is that?
Well, you know, you think about these blue-collar workers, and they're worried about this kind of outsourcing to low-cost labor in other countries. That's been a big part of the worry for workers when it comes to auto workers in Mexico being taking a larger part of the work that goes into the cars that are maybe put together in the U.S., but parts being made in other parts of the world. So he's the kind of voter who's looking for something to happen in Washington that will make it harder for companies to move their jobs overseas. So if it means tariffs on the products that come back, he's all for it. He's not kidding himself that the Tenneco factory can come back. It's mm-hmm. literally rubble on the side of the interstate. But there are a lot of towns along that stretch of Interstate 80 in Nebraska that have similar small manufacturing plants that support rural jobs. I mean, these are towns that used to get a lot of jobs provided by the agriculture industry. Over the years, that's declined just because agriculture is more productive with greater technology. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to these kinds of factory jobs, they're even more important.
So Stephanie Kelton, you have two residents of Dawson County, Nebraska, with two different ideas of how trade policy should be handled. You know, it's not likely that both farmers and middle-class workers can both come out as winners here in Dawson County and in the rest of the country under the president's proposed trade policies. Do I have that? Again, is that my thinking right there?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, you're going to have, regardless of what happens, you're going to have people who are winners and people who are losers. And, you know, retail industry doesn't like the idea of tariffs. You're hearing from some farmers that they do like the idea of tariffs because they believe that these are the sorts of things that are going to protect their markets and give them greater access while keeping foreign access reduced in the U.S. And so, you know, you're going to have people who view this differently from their own lens. Mm-hmm. And the retail, like I said, you know, retailers are not excited about the idea of tariffs. Consumer advocacy groups are not excited about the idea of tariffs because there's a belief that these are passed through into the form of higher prices for consumers at the end of the day. So, yeah, you're going to have winners and losers.
So there's a lot of wild cards being thrown into the deck here when it comes to what the president wants to do. Can you just give us just an overall sense, Stephanie, of what Donald Trump's trade policy is, at least what we know so far?
Well, what we know really is, you know, they're talking about this thing called a border adjustment tax. And that's mostly what people are talking about
That's a tariff, right?
That's a tariff. So mm-hmm. it's a tax on imports. And what they're attempting to do is to, you know, reduce the amount of penetration of the U.S. markets by foreign competition. So protect domestic producers, protect domestic industries, while at the same time hoping that there's not retaliation and that governments in the rest of the world don't slap similar tariffs on so that it becomes a no-win situation, a zero-sum mm-hmm. game, right?
And that's where farmers would lose, ag producers,
exactly.
because they're counting on having these markets to ship off their products to.
Exactly. And I think that's what you're seeing in this article that you've been referring to, is that there is concern, at least on the part of some of the people that are featured in the story, that there will be retaliation and that this will actually, at the end of the day, could end up hurting farmers.
Because based on all your vast knowledge on all things economic here, should farmers be concerned that there will be some sort of retaliatory action taken by other countries? Is that a typical response?
I don't think it's unreasonable. It would be surprising to me if the U.S. were to begin to, you know, put tariffs on goods coming in from the rest of the world, and the rest of the world would just sit back and say, well, I guess we just have to take this one on the chin. Mm-hmm. We're not going to retaliate. I would anticipate that countries like China and others that export a lot of goods and services to the U.S. Would respond with similar measures. So mm-hmm. I think it's a legitimate concern.
So when people talk about trade policy, then this is serious business. It affects a lot of people in this country.
Oh, it sure does. It sure does. I mean, industries both direct and indirectly are affected by these sorts of policies. And so, you know, we don't know what's going to happen. And keep in mind, you know, while Donald Trump talks about getting serious and doing more to protect jobs at home and using the tariff as a way to do that, Republicans, by and large, have not historically been excited by the idea of protectionist policies. They tend to be more free trade oriented. Mm-hmm. And so even within the Republican Party, it seems to me it would be very difficult. Now, there are some things I think that Donald Trump could do unilaterally through executive action. But if they want to do anything legislatively, it's going to be a pretty big uphill battle. battle within their own party.
I was going to say, Stephanie, when it comes to executive action, the president has quite a bit of authority when it comes to trade policy.
Yeah, that's my understanding as well.
I
don't know the legalities of it, but yeah, I think he does have some leeway there to do some unilateral things.
Well, Grant Gerlach, so up in Dawson County, Nebraska, then, how nervous is the farm community just in general? What did you pick up when you were up there?
Well, there's so much uncertainty sort of in the ag economy right now anyway, that this is the sort of the area where they're concerned about a further shock to the industry when they really don't need it. So prices are already sort of break even where they are. And if there were,
in fact, Don Beatty's
sort of
losing money, and you have him saying
exactly
in your story, he's doing all this work on his 1,500 acres. He's going to lose money this year.
Exactly. He's getting ready to go in the field knowing that he's going to be in the red when those crops come back out again. He can't afford not to farm it, but he knows he's going to lose money on the year. So what he's hoping for, sort of the best he's hoping for, is that President Trump will get busy and maybe set up some bilateral agreements, maybe with Japan or some other countries in Asia, that will sort of keep a rosy picture when it comes to the exports that he depends on. But yeah, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of unease when it comes to the kinds of things they're hearing.
You know, Grant, farmers traditionally like trade deals like NAFTA and the Trans-Pacific Partnership that Trump says he dislikes. Why do farmers like those pacts, and why does President Trump dislike them to the extent that he does?
Well, I think a lot of it does come down to who the winners and losers tend to be when these negotiations go on. And commodity farmers do tend to come out well. And part of that is because the U.S. competes favorably to other parts of the world when it comes to producing corn and soybeans and other commodities. We're a really low-cost, efficient ag industry. So when it comes to competing against farmers in Mexico or South Korea or Japan, we have an edge there when it comes to the cost of the goods that we send their way. And so it becomes a real touchy issue with farmers overseas. So you already hear Mexico talking about, well, we'll look to Brazil or Argentina, which are some of the top competitors for the U.S. when it comes to commodities like corn and soybeans. And that really gets farmers in Nebraska worried.
Yeah. Stephanie Kelton, if Republicans tend to be free traders, Donald Trump is willing to use tariffs in some ways to protect industries back here in the heartland. At least that's the theory. What was President Obama's overall philosophy when it came to trade? Where did he come down on this?
Well, he was a free trade supporter. I mean, remember the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP deal, was something he was very supportive of and worked very hard to build enough support to get that legislation through. So at the end of the day, President Obama was free trade oriented, mm-hmm. not a protectionist by any stretch.
Who was the last protectionist president when it came to trade? Can you recall?
Geez, I mean, I don't recall probably the most recent. I can tell you that 100 years ago, Teddy Roosevelt had this figured out pretty well in terms of, you know, the way that he took antitrust very mm-hmm. seriously and so forth. So in a way, it was less about the U.S. versus the rest of the world then, as opposed to parts of the U.S. versus other parts of the U.S. And
yeah.
So there was real concern that that farmers in the middle of the country, the heartland, were disadvantaged by strong, powerful interests in the East. And so mm-hmm. there were lots of measures taken. And Roosevelt, of course, the old trust buster, took that very seriously back then. But in a way, that had to do with intra-oriented trade.
Okay. If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about trade policy and how it might affect farmers here in the heartland and others as well. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is the number. You can also tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Grant Gerlach, which sectors of the farming community, you know, have reason to be especially concerned here? Because I read that soybean farmers, for instance, are among those who are very worried.
Soybeans, possibly wheat, but that's because of the share of production that is exported. So a lot more of our soybeans leave the U.S. than corn, for instance. About 12% of the corn supply is exported each year, compared to around 45% of the soybean supply. Now, we're talking corn soybean farmers, generally those are the same people. Also, pork is a product that's exported more than beef, for instance. So you do see segments of the beef industry that actually do like to see these trade deals revisited because of it's affected their industry differently than the pork industry and how supply chains work across the beef industry across North and South America. So typically those soybeans and those grain farmers are the ones who are first to stand up on export issues.
Stephanie Kelton, do we have any sense of timing here as to when the president might begin to implement these policies, either by taking them before Congress or by signing executive orders? Is there a timetable that's been laid out here?
You know, I don't think there is. We just got about a week ago, last week, I guess, the skinny budget, which is the first real sort of glimpse into the legislative movements that are taking place. You've got, of course, the health care debate that they're very much bogged down in. The president has said that he's not going to embark on tax reform until after they deal with health care, and he really wants to do tax reform. So if he were, he's said, if I were prioritizing, I had my druthers, we'd be doing tax reform first. So he's not talking about doing trade, going after trade first. So where trade falls on his, you know, list, on the priority list, I don't think it's clear to us yet, but he's certainly not making it the priority at the moment.
Grant, to what extent are you sensing any second guessing among some of the Dawson County farmers that you met up there about their support for Donald Trump in last year's election?
No, you know, they weren't really second guessing their support in the election for Donald Trump. I mean, there were other reasons that they supported him besides just those sort of bottom line business reasons. For instance, Don Beatty mentioned that he likes the choice of Neil Gorsuch for the Supreme Court. So there are other things going on in their mind. Also, they weigh the trade issue against other things. Don Beatty was glad to hear about some possible deregulation. There's the Water of the United States rules that a lot of farmers didn't like that was immediately set up for a possible repeal by the EPA. And there are others. So they're sort of weighing, you know, am I going to be able to save money by deregulation? Am I going to lose money by trade? There are a lot of balls up in the air, and they're not sure exactly how they're going to land.
Yeah. Well, Grant, I know you have to run, but thanks for taking the time this morning. Grant's story can be found at harvestpublicmedia.org as part of the United and Divided series. Grant, I always appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks, Steve.
You bet. Thanks. Let's go to Frank from Lawrence on the Kansas side. Frank, good morning.
Good morning. I don't know if your panelists and yourself know about trade with Cuba, because I know the Kansas farmers kind of depend on trade with Cuba, and I'm not sure if Trump is trying to stop that or not. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks. Yeah, thank you, Frank. And Donald Trump has offered some mixed signals on Cuba lately, Stephanie, and Senator Jerry Moran of Kansas is pushing for more wide-open trade with Cuba. Any sense of all this, or maybe not?
Actually, I really don't.
Yeah.
I'll just be honest. I haven't been following this, and it's not been on my radar. So I'm sorry to your listener. I don't have much to offer on that.
What stops this country, Stephanie, from just saying, we are going to be free traders, we're going to simplify all this, and we're not going to impose tariffs on anything? We'll let the market dictate where we go and how we go forward on this.
Well, we do have tariffs in place today. We have some tariffs in place. So what stops us from either ratcheting that up or ratcheting that down is just a decision by Congress. It's just a legislative decision. But there are so many, as you've been talking about, the vested interests on both sides and lobbying groups on both sides. I mean, American Farm Bureau Federation, a very powerful lobbying group with interests it's defending, and the National Retailers Association with different interests. And so what stops it is, I guess, pressure from both sides keeps things more or less with the status quo.
What do we have tariffs on now?
Oh, I mean, I don't actually know what...
But they exist out
there. Oh, yeah, there are tariffs. Yeah, there was a study just done recently by the economist who was President Obama's chief economist, Jason Furman. And he put out a recent study. And so he looked at how current the tariffs that are in place today impact consumers based on income group. And so who benefits and who pays the higher, disproportionately higher cost. So what his conclusion was just essentially that tariffs are nothing more than a regressive tax, and that those at the bottom end of the income distribution end up disproportionately bearing the burden of tariffs.
Okay. We're going to leave our conversation there. I want to thank Stephanie Kelton, a professor of economics over at UMKC, for filling us in on trade policies, and they are complicated, that's for sure. Stephanie, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about, is it possible to retrofit your home to make it tornado-proof? I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. We had Mamie Hughes on the program yesterday, one of Kansas City's most devoted activists. I also spoke with Keith Lockhart, conductor of the Boston Pops Orchestra. You can find those conversations at kcur.org/uptodate. Well, the Indie Foreign and Documentary Film Critics return to the studio tomorrow. We'll preview the Kansas City Film Fest, which starts April 5th, and they'll discuss movies now showing on area screens. Just a few weeks ago, an EF3 tornado ripped through Oak Grove, damaging nearly 500 homes and a few businesses. Fortunately, no lives were lost. While there's no way yet to stop a natural disaster like a tornado from happening, it is possible to build homes that are more resistant to wind damage. Joining me now are Leslie Chapman Henderson. She's the CEO of the Federal Alliance for Safe Homes, or FLASH, a nonprofit advocate for strengthening homes. She joins us out of WFSU in Tallahassee. Leslie, good morning.
Good morning.
George Schluter is also here. He's a longtime home builder in the KC metro area and a former president of the Home Builders Association of Greater Kansas City. He joins me here in studio. And George, good morning. Nice to have you.
Good morning. Thank you.
Well, Leslie, Kansas City is pretty much in the middle of Tornado Alley. So is there anything we Midwesterners should be on the lookout for this year when it comes to what the predictions are for what kinds of storm season we might be having here?
Well, I don't know that the prediction ever changes. We have approximately 1,000 tornadoes every year in the United States. But the good news is we're taking about 1,000.
Yeah.
Yep. And 20 of those are going to be violent at the 2, 3, and maybe even the EF4 level. But we don't know exactly where they'll strike, as you know.
What's the most important part, Leslie, in protecting a home from high winds?
Well, we have to start with life safety. The most important part is there, and historically, that's all we've ever focused on because we didn't know what we know now, and that's that we can build better to withstand the lower-level tornadoes and even the first level of violent, and there's some things we're doing, and that's what we're looking at. The damage investigations in the past 5 years have told us we don't have to give up on keeping the house intact.
Hmm. So what are some of the changes that can make homes more tornado-resistant?
So we're taking a page out of the book of building to withstand hurricanes, and we're looking at, obviously, the connection. So the roof to the wall to the foundation, reinforcing those, using better roofing materials themselves, nailing patterns, meaning how many nails we use to keep down the roof deck. We just want to put more in there.
Hmm.
Upgraded shingles, as I mentioned, and things like reinforced garage doors. All these products are available. We just need to apply them into these zones.
And how about construction materials being used? Are there any changes being suggested there?
Well, I think the manufacturers are coming out with, and it's just like anything else, whenever we innovate in the product line. The early days, we looked at better shingles. You didn't have a lot of options, but now you have hundreds. High wind shingles have made it into the marketplace. And as you can imagine, the more we have, the more affordable they become.
You know, George, as a contractor, you know, is what Leslie suggests here, how practical is it? I mean, the notion of putting more nails into the roof, that sort of just seems to make common sense.
Well, yes, it does make common sense, and it's being done. We've seen a number of changes over the years in the building codes, the requirement for underlayment additional improvements in it went into the 2012 code, which the Kansas City metropolitan area is under.
What's underlayment? What is that?
It's material between the sheeting, the plywood or OSB on the roof, and the roof shingles themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And underlayment, if it's a glue down type or a seal down type, that certainly helps keep that roof shingle down. And also, if the roof shingle's torn off, it provides additional protection for the homeowner
mm-hmm.
in that condition.
Are we slow? Were we slow getting to these points to help protect our homes against high winds?
Well, yes, I think in some degree we have not recognized it. We've looked at tornadoes and very high wind events as isolated cases that don't happen very often. And yes, a couple of weeks ago we had two in the Kansas City metropolitan area, but they were in very isolated areas. We've not had a major tornado in the Kansas City metropolitan area for many, many years.
Mm-hmm. These changes that you say have been made in recent years, George, to what extent does it become difficult to balance safety with affordability? Are we adding a lot of cost to the construction of a home?
Well, certainly some areas can be. Other areas are not that expensive on the thing, and I think builders are responsive to it.
When you say areas, you mean different ideas for making homes more
yes,
windproof?
Just a simple matter of additional nailing. That's a very common thing that's happened on it. We've gone through evolution of things. We've gone from nails to staples to wide face staples, back to nails, gone from
ring shank nails.
Straight shanks to ring shank nails, yes.
Yeah. And what's being used now?
It's a mixture of all of those.
Wow, I didn't realize that. So in recent years, has there been any change in how you go about building homes? You know, what else is being done to take tornadoes into consideration here?
Well, I think builders are responsive to what their customers want, and we try to respond to those things. I've been in the building business for 40-plus years, and I have very rarely had a customer ask me what I should do to help my house in protection from a tornado.
I was going to say, do people buy houses and they wonder how tornado-proof a house might be?
I don't think so, no.
It doesn't occur to them at the time, right?
No. I've been a custom builder for 25 years, and in that time, I bring it up with my customers. I don't build a safe room according to FEMA standards, but I recommend to all my customers that we provide some shelter area for protection of life in a home on the thing, and mm-hmm. it can be done for very little cost. However, if I'm going to meet the requirements that FEMA has established, it's just out of the realm of what most people are willing to pay.
Hmm. You know, Leslie, a lot of what your organization is trying to do is to reform building codes. Why do they need to change, and what needs to change?
Well, it's a progression. The building code, and most of the consumers I don't think understand, the code is a minimum standard. It's not a gold standard. But over time, findings, whether they're engineering damage investigations after a tornado or laboratory testing or other types of things, those findings do make their way eventually into the building codes. But beyond code practices are kind of the leading edge of that innovation. So things like the dual objective tornado design philosophy, which is what we're talking about, this is new thinking in the last several years off of old practices, just like George just said.
Mm-hmm.
Taking things we know how to do, doing them in a package, and then testing them to see what a difference they can make. You know, and it's not just that we're talking about the fact that most tornadoes are weaker. Even when you have an EF4 or an EF5, most of the damage in that pattern is at the lower wind speeds. So there are opportunities here, and that's the point we're trying to make.
I don't get that. Why would that be that most of the damage at the lower wind speed? I don't understand that.
Well, so for example, if you look at a pattern in an outbreak like Tuscaloosa, okay,
mm-hmm.
the EF4, EF5 wind speed damage was only sustained for part of the total damage pattern. Okay, 86% of the damage to that area was from wind speeds much lower because it doesn't come to ground as a 4 and maintain 4 status throughout.
Oh,
see what I'm saying? It's
yeah.
a progression of wind speeds. So even when you have those, you know, violent and so-called incredible EF5s, you're still going to see damage at the 3, 2, 1, and 0 level. And inside of that pattern is where the opportunity is to use these practices as a package and protect those homes. And that's what's exciting about this. This is new thinking. For decades, you know, it was very logical. There wasn't, we believed, an affordable way to address the property mm-hmm. and to save it. And but that's what's different now.
I was going to say, though, if George is right here, Leslie, and consumers aren't demanding homes that are more windproof from tornadoes, where's the political will, where's the push coming from to make our homes safer from these things?
Well, that's also another great point, and that is what we are trying to do. Now, I do have to say the real estate market, there have been some recent economic studies that are excellent on exactly that question. Say, for example, Moore, Oklahoma, also in Tornado Alley. Consumers there, according to several economic studies coming out of Texas and Oklahoma, consumers there don't want a home without a tornado safe room. And there's even good news on that front. You can construct to the FEMA guidelines, and that's one option. But tornado shelters have made it into the marketplace that are tested and certified to withstand winds up to 200 and beyond. And the cost of those shelters is coming down. You can even go on HomeDepot.com and buy a shelter for about $1,500 and have it delivered. But that's the progression over time of these products, too, and getting the word out.
And these are shelters that are outside of your home. You have to go out the back door and go crawl into
Don't
that kind
of thing?
Don't
have to. No, it's fantastic. They can be in the home and also serve as a closet or a bathroom. They can be in the garage. They can be above ground, below ground. They can be in the backyard and an out garage. I mean, we had so few options in the 80s with safe rooms. We just basically started with the concrete block, you know, reinforced and mm-hmm. filled. But like everything else, time and ingenuity have kicked in. The property protection side of this now is just catching up. We feel mm-hmm. very good about our ability to protect lives even in an EF5.
Yeah.
What we're working on now is protecting your biggest investment, which is the house.
Right. George, let's talk about building codes and how that enters in here, because both Kansas and Missouri are home rule states, meaning that building codes are adopted locally rather than by the state as a whole. How does that work for you?
I believe it works very well.
But every municipality has it.
The conditions that exist in southeast Missouri are a whole lot different than what we have in northwest Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing. What's in the needs and requirements in far southwest Kansas are a lot different than northeast Kansas. So I believe that local adoption makes sense. And when you have the codes being adopted at the local level, I believe we cut out a lot of the bureaucracy that gets built into it. And so I believe we have better codes in that regard.
Are there any risks to letting the cities decide one by one? I mean, do they tend to fall behind new developments, that kind of thing?
Well, codes are always behind new developments, new products, new materials. Most of the metropolitan area cities on our six-year cycle, we adopted the 2012 family of international building codes in this part of the country, and most of the cities are under that. The 18 codes will be coming out. They've all been approved. They just haven't been published yet.
Right.
And I'm sure each of the cities will look at those. And most of the jurisdictions tend to follow the lead of the two largest cities in terms of permitting. That's Kansas City, Missouri, and Overland Park.
Mm-hmm. You know, Claire, George, from Northwest Missouri, called in wondering about the use of hurricane hooks on the roof and the wind flow benefits of dome construction. What is a hurricane hook?
Well, I call them a hurricane clip, and it's a metal device that simply connects the top plate of your wall to the roof truss, and it helps hold it in place rather than relying upon a toenail to a nail driven in at an angle to hold the roof truss material to the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, in the 2012 code, it did require hurricane clips be installed on truss roofs.
So if some folks listening, George, are interested in retrofitting an existing home to make it more tornado-proof, what would you advise?
I don't believe I'm a good enough expert, Steve, to talk about that. I'm in new construction.
Leslie, what would you say?
Well, if they have roof access, there are some retrofit hurricane straps, ties, and clips that can be used. If you can get to that roof-to-wall connection, it can make a big difference. It's going to be a little trickier, obviously, wall to foundation. But there, you know, the roof is a key. If we keep that roof on, we have a really good shot at keeping the house intact. So
the roof is more important than the foundation then?
Well, most of the trouble usually starts with the roof and its failure because of the way the wind slams in and then goes to an uplift scenario. So it basically is pulling on the roof, trying to pull it off. But, you know, there are things that have been tested and verified for uplift resistance as simple as applying premium floor adhesive on the underside in the attic between where the deck and the truss meet in that joint. A quarter inch, a bead of that can deliver a lot of resistance too, and that's very inexpensive.
So when it comes to wind safety then, what do you think people should get right the first time they build to avoid having to fix it later? George, that might fall into your category.
Well, I believe the best way is to do a good job of checking out your contractor to be sure he's up to date and doing the things that should be done.
That's hard for consumers, though. I mean, that industry of contractors on my block, we've had a whole series of remodels on my block with experiences ranging from pretty good to awful and everything in between. That's a tough industry for consumers to manage, George.
It is. I agree.
And what can be done about that? Because something needs to be done, because I think it's hurting your industry.
Well, in new construction, I think it is being done. Johnson County, all of the municipalities require a contractor licensing, as does Kansas City, Missouri, Lee Summit, and Independence. And all of those require continuing education by the contractor to keep his license in force. So it's happening there. Unfortunately, in the aftermarket or the remodel market, I don't believe it's being done as well. So I can't offer a whole lot of how to check that out good.
Yeah. Well, Leslie, it's not always just about the homes, though. What are some general safety tips that people need to be aware of during a storm?
Well, the most important tip for anything, there really isn't any part of the U.S. that's without some type of disaster risk, and you are your own best protection in terms of awareness. With smartphone apps, the radio, all the different ways we receive information, we are getting plenty of weather information all the time. We typically know when the conditions are right for tornadoes. And that is usually that decision-making about, okay, it looks like we're going to have some type of activity. Let me make sure I pay attention and have contingency plans of where you're going to be. Where are those safe rooms and shelters? Say you're at your place of work or school or the mall or wherever you are. Just that self-awareness is probably the first step. And that's where a lot of people, you know, can miss out by not really paying attention, as we've seen in these disasters. It shouldn't come as a surprise. You know, we have so much information and everyone has an app. We even have one that will even wake up and say tornado warning. You know, the NOAA weather radios used to be so cumbersome and only plugged in at your house, and then it would go off when it really wasn't, you know, over alerting. Those days are gone. You know, we can be aware, and then we have to know where we're going to be and what places are safe. You know, homes with safe rooms, homes built differently. We're very big on transparency in the construction industry, and we did look at Johnson County and the metropolitan areas, and you guys are doing a great job with your code adoption and licensing, continuing ed. Those are all the ingredients. But the transparency on your house itself, think about your car. Your car comes with a sticker, and it tells you all kinds of stuff about your car. We want to see the same thing done on the house, right?
That's
next to that circuit breaker box. Year built, permit built, who built.
That's
what was
point.
Their license?
Good point.
You know, all that good stuff.
Well, that's Leslie Chapman Henderson. She's CEO of the Federal Alliance for Safe Homes. Leslie, thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
George Schluter is a former president of the Home Builders Association of Greater Kansas City. George, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Coming up, Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list.
Now the party's over. I'm so tired. Then I see you coming out of nowhere. that conversation or a notion.
Brian McTavish is here to talk about cool stuff to do this weekend, and I always loved that song. Great tune. Avalon, Brian Ferry, Roxy Music.
You've got taste.
Yes. Is that what that is?
Oh, yeah, sure. And I want to be nice
song.
To you.
Just a great song.
Well, yeah. You know who else liked that song besides you and me?
Who?
People who went to stereo stores in 1980,
yeah,
at least the stereo store where I worked,
yeah,
because we put on Avalon, and they bought the speakers.
Is that right?
Yeah, it was like, buy the speakers.
Really?
And I think, well, I mean,
because it's
a beautiful song by a beautiful voice, and that would be Brian Ferry, who is just the drop-dead debonair rock legend himself.
Right. He'll be in town tomorrow night.
My gosh, he's going to be here. I don't know how long it's been. Friday night, 8 o'clock, Uptown Theater. But sure, it was Brian Ferry's perfectly seductive, smooth, intoxicating delivery. Right, such a classy guy.
Yeah.
But I'll be honest with you. It was 1980. I think maybe the first CD I ever held in my hand, Steve, was Avalon by Roxy Music, right? Because this was the big Roxy Music album, Avalon, and he was the front man for Roxy Music for many years on vinyl. Remember, they had those sexy, I don't know what they were. They were strange in a way, covers of just women sort of staring out at you in various forms of, they weren't quite naked, were they? But people heard this CD. They'd never heard a CD before.
Right.
It was crystal clear. Anyway, the crystal clear voice of Brian Ferry will rule 8 o'clock Friday at the Uptown Theater. Did you like Roxy?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Did you like Love is the Drug?
No. No, I didn't like that one. But
well, that was different. You like that smoother
sounding. Yeah, the smooth thing. That's what I like.
Avalon, right. Yeah. Well, he's going to do stuff from Roxy. He'll do the early, he'll do the late, he'll do some solo stuff, but I tell you what, he will not have a hair out of place. He will not sing a note out of place. He will kill.
Okay.
And it's not sold out. I was shocked.
Really?
Tickets still available.
Okay.
You betcha.
All right.
Yep.
What do we have here?
All right, they're coming.
Who's coming?
Who's coming? There
you
go.
Yeah.
The firemen are coming. Mm. The firemen are the characters in Ray Bradbury's futuristic 1953 novel, Fahrenheit 451.
Oh, sure. All
and the
right.
firemen are just civic employees, government workers.
Right.
And they go around, and their job is to just sort of matter-of-factly find and burn all the books they can.
Mm-hmm.
They burn every book that they are, every book. That's every single thing.
Right.
Every book. So let's go see the stage play, shall we, of Ray Bradbury's classic tale of censorship and sadness. It happens. It's the same title, Fahrenheit 451. It happens at 7:30 p.m. Saturday, 2 in the afternoon Sunday.
Cool.
They have a pre-show talkback session at 1. And where would you go to do this? Where would you go to deal with the awfulness that we want to avoid? We don't want North Korea, please. Let's not go there.
White Theater at the Jewish Community Center of Greater Kansas City.
Three times, yes. So it's a bit dated. Sure, it's the internet age. But you know what? Censorship is censorship, and we're against it.
Be sure to see Brian's 6 heavy things to do in Kansas City this weekend. Just go to kcur.org. Let's talk men singing. Lots of men singing.
Well, yes. No, that's right. That's a great name for an album. Lots of men singing.
Yeah.
That's actually, we're actually hearing lots of men singing that in our ears. That's the Seattle Men's Chorus doing a selection from Tyler's Suite. Tyler's Suite is penned by Stephen Schwartz. He's the world famous composer of Broadway's hit Wicked and Godspell and so many others.
Mm-hmm.
And so why is this pertinent? Because that's the centerpiece event of Identity. Identity is the Heartland Men's Chorus presentation. It's centered around anti-bullying. You know, we're not going to take this anymore. If there's one LGBT person who's bullied, well, that's one too many, mm-hmm. right? So performances are at 8 o'clock Saturday and 4 o'clock Sunday. Now, in addition to the 100 men of the Heartland Men's Chorus, on hand, we'll have the 100 men of the Twin Cities Gay Men's Chorus.
Wow.
There'll also be, it's a multi-tiered thing. It's sort of a concert and a conversation. There'll also be celebrity TED talker Morgana Bailey of State Street there. And Tyler Sweet is actually inspired by the Tyler Clementi, who took his own life after being bullied for who he was. His mother will be there, and she'll talk about that. 8 o'clock Saturday, 4 o'clock Sunday, Folly Theater, uplifting event.
She played tambourine with a silver jingle, and she must have known the words to at least a million tunes. But the one most requested by the man she knew as Cowboy.
And they still sound good, don't they?
They speak for themselves, yes, and they'll sing for themselves. Yes. That's the Oak Ridge Boys, country stalwarts. That's the Y'all Come Back Saloon. They'll do those and all those good songs. 7:30 Sunday at the Muriel Kaufman Theater at the Kaufman Center for the Performing Arts.
Which one's got
arts.
The really deep voice?
The guy with the long beard.
Long beard. I thought that.
Notice how I avoided saying his name.
I can't remember either.
I think he fell the way he came back. Now he's back. It'd be a great time for the old timers. You and me.
And finally today.
Yeah. When the night has come. Oh. And the land, it is dark, and the moon is
declining. Listen to that voice. That's just amazing.
It's a weekend of golden throats,
wow,
I'm telling you.
No kidding.
It's the one. It's the only.
There's always stuff going on here in town. It keeps you employed, doesn't it? Yeah.
It keeps us talking. That's the one and only Aaron Neville, Steve, the heavenly tenor, 8 o'clock Saturday night at the Star Pavilion at Ameristar Casino. He'll do that, I bet, and I'll bet, you know what he's going to do? He has a great cover of Chuck Berry's You Never Can Tell, and with Berry's passing at age 90 this week, it would be a great tribute.
Wow. That's Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you, pal.
Tomorrow on the show, film. We'll talk about independent art and foreign films showing in the area and the upcoming Kansas City Film Fest. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tadakoro. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.
I won't cry, no, and I won't shed another tear, just as long